This is Gabfest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political Gabfest, the crisis in Ukraine deepens. Can Washington do anything to restrain Putin? Also, marijuana legalization is coming, and faster than anyone expected. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture Gabfest, normcore, a hipster fashion trend that features the most boring middle American clothes you can possibly find. Then, has the time come to curb the excesses of frat boy culture? And then, the highs and lows of this year's Oscars.
Here to perform the Oscar-nominated, gorgeously empowering song, Let It Go, from the Oscar-winning animated movie Frozen, please welcome the wickedly talented one and only Adele Dazeem.
We'll start with the Political Gabfest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz, live in front of a huge crowd at 6th and I Historic Synagogue in Washington, D.C. On this episode of the Gabfest, Crimea is in Russian hands, Putin is menacing eastern Ukraine, and Washington wonders, can we do anything about it? Then, marijuana is legal in Washington State and Colorado and heading toward decriminalization in much of the rest of the country. Should the end of prohibition be celebrated or feared? Joining me on the stage here at 6th and I is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And Slate senior editor, Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
The crisis in Ukraine is getting stranger by the day. As we tape, Russian troops occupy the Crimea, though they are pretending not to. And the local Crimean government has called for a vote about whether the region should stay part of Ukraine or become part of Russia. Vladimir Putin is also menacing eastern Ukraine, while Europe and the United States are pondering various sticks to punish Russia, including travel bans and possible sanctions. We have a special guest to talk about the crisis, New Republic senior editor Julia Yaffe, who is just back from Russia and the Ukraine. And she's been writing tremendous stories for the New Republic about what Putin's been up to, including a cover story that's out this week about eastern Ukraine. Julia, welcome to the Gabfest.
Thanks for having me.
So Hillary Clinton had said this notorious thing this week where she compared what Vladimir Putin is doing very explicitly to Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. Is that a decent comparison?
I think it would be a decent comparison if Hitler then hadn't gone on to do the things he did in the 1940s. But what he's doing now is very comparable to Hitler in the 30s, you know, ostensibly protecting fellow speakers of the language, fellow members of the same ethnos. I don't know if it's going to end in mass mechanized genocide, but it's apt in a very narrow way.
But acts of aggression to take territory, that's the parallel that you see?
Yeah, but aggression that's not met with any response, so it ends up being not really kind of aggression, just kind of waltzing in and taking.
So Putin, in 2008, he took back, he invaded Georgia, and more or less took back
and Russian, got away with
and it. Got away with it. Is there any reason to think that that is not what's going to happen here? He's going to take Crimea, and in a few months we'll be like, oh, yeah, Crimea, that's okay. That's sort of the Russian part of Ukraine.
Yeah, that's probably what's going to happen. I mean, I don't see the alternatives. I mean, who's going to... And the same thing happened in Georgia, right? That was a hot war, a hot conflict, and we had a much more, you know, people have been slamming Barack Obama for this, for being weak and indecisive and not standing up to Putin, but we had George W. Bush in office then. I mean, that was not a man who shied away from starting wars, and, you know, and he couldn't stop Putin either because nobody wants to, you know, Iraq didn't actually have nuclear weapons, Afghanistan didn't have nuclear weapons, and, you know, armies haven't been... I don't know. You don't go to war with Russia.
The calculus is different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I guess the three options. One is he continues into the rest of Ukraine. The other is he sits tight in what we were describing. And I guess the third is the Angela Merkel kind of find him an off-ramp. What is that, given your what you've written about how unpredictable he is, but also I loved what you wrote about if you're going to try to predict him, just take the most cynical approach, and that's where he will go. So given that, is an off-ramp even... What would an off-ramp look like? Is that silly talk? What's...
An off-ramp is, I think, wishful thinking on the West part. It's what we would like to think to increase our own feeling of agency and potency. I don't think that there's really anything we could have done to prevent it, to prevent this. An off-ramp would look like him keeping Crimea or annexing Crimea or having it exist in this legally gray zone where it's not annexed but it's not no longer really part of Ukraine and it's autonomous but within Russia's orbit. A destabilized southern and eastern Ukraine that then destabilizes the government in Kiev and keeps it as a kind of vassal state to Russia where it's not strong enough or economically sound enough to join the European Union.
So wait, that's the off ramp?
That's what I'm saying. That's not a, that's
it's
not
just calling it.
No, that's right. Just, I think that's probably the most, I mean, I will probably eat my words in a week, but that's probably the most likely outcome. And then we'll call it an off ramp to make it sound like, to pat ourselves on the back and say that we did everything we could.
It could have been worse.
But really what's going to happen is we're just going to punish him for what he did, which is fair enough, because the amazing duality of Putin's Russia is that on one hand, Russia rants and raves about how it's a European country and it's not Asia, and please don't call us Asia, and we're Europe, and Europe would be nothing without Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. Russia then signs on to these treaties, and it wants to be part of organizations like the G8 and the G20, and wants to sit at the table with the big boys and be seen as one of the European big boys or the Western big boys. Then, as soon as people say, oh, hey, by the way, these are the big boy standards that you have to apply by, they say, whoa, hey, come on, we're a very unique country with a very unique history and a deep Russian soul that you can't possibly understand with your stupid American mind.
And it means that we need more territory and to have this sphere of influence around Russia.
Or we need this, or we need that, or we need to repress the opposition or shut down independent media, and this is just how we do things, and you can't possibly understand, but yet we're Europe. And so I think the punishment is actually instituting visa bans and asset freezes and bans on real estate is actually very apt because the Russian elite, their families don't live in Russia. So all this talk about a great Russia, blah, 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 they don't believe it themselves because their families don't live there and they don't keep their money there and they own most of their land outside of it.
So it's actually punishing the right people in
exactly,
Russia.
Exactly, yeah.
So could this have been foreseen, or if the specific set of events couldn't have been foreseen, was there a way in which U.S. policymakers have this kind of rosy view about Putin that they just misunderstand him? That as we think about Putin going forward, that people need to have a kind of wise up about him?
Mm-hmm. We at TNR identified Crimea as a kind of potential pressure point that he could lean on, as well as the east and the south of Ukraine. But generally what Western analysts miss about Russia is they try to impose a kind of Western rationale on them. That, oh, sure, Putin wouldn't do this because it would hurt him economically. Or he cares a lot about his reputation, and so he wouldn't do this. He wouldn't do something that would hit at his reputation so hard. It's just not true. Putin is driven by things other than money, even though he's a tremendously wealthy man, and we don't even know how much money he has. He cares about bigger things.
I mean, you wrote about his press conference on Tuesday, and you suggested that he seemed. What is his form of nuttiness?
What happened was he was just rambling and couldn't quite get his story straight, which is also exhibit 70 million in why this is not at all about the coup in Kiev or the alleged coup in Kiev or Russian speakers in Crimea. He was saying, he was bouncing from thought to thought, like, Viktor Yanukovych is still the legitimate president of Ukraine. However, I can't talk to anyone in Ukraine because they have there's nobody at my level that I can talk to. Well, hello, you just said that there was a president. They need to have elections to elect a president. Don't they have a president? But we can't have elections because there's terrorists all over Ukraine. And we wouldn't recognize, and things like just like
contradiction.
The logic folding in on itself, and then getting this kind of crazy Cold War, almost like North Korean rhetoric about how Americans are sitting in their laboratories in America and experimenting on Ukrainians like they're rats.
Yes, I was shocked by that. That's my own naivete, but I was so struck by that line because it just seemed so incredibly paranoid.
This is the problem with Putin. He's always been a little bit paranoid. He's always been given to conspiracy thinking. But it's gotten a lot worse over the years, especially since he came back to office in for his third term as president. And anti-Americanism and this Cold War rhetoric have been a cornerstone of that. They have been used to legitimize his return to power, that he needs to come back and rule Russia with a strong hand because, once again, Russia is beset by enemies. And the most terrifying thing to me about this whole crisis is what's happening on the Russian home front. The way that whatever was left of the independent media in Russia has been obliterated and rolled into the ground. What you're seeing on state television is utterly horrifying. I mean, the kind of jingoistic, foaming at the mouth, anti-Western stuff. It's just, it's really, I mean, when Abby Martin, the Russia Today anchor, condemned Russia's invasion of Crimea on the air, Margarita Simonyan, the editor-in-chief of Russia Today, issued a statement that was, I mean, it just, it reminded me of reading, you know, Pravda from the 1930s. It was talking about how this is how strong the American propaganda machine is, that it corrupts the minds of even the most ardent youth. And because it's so strong, I'm quoting, and because it's so strong, we will have to work even harder to defeat the Western propaganda machine.
Hmm.
Like, what are you, where is this coming from? This is 2014.
If only we were that effective.
No, but this is the paradox, right? That on one hand, we're incredibly wily and strong, and we can corrupt the minds of the most ardent youth with the flame of revolution burning strong in their hearts. At the same time, we're very weak and corrupt, and we are easily defeated because we're so stupid.
Which is always the fascist duality about the enemy, right? That it has to be all things.
What do you make of the administration? Well, they say two things. They say, one, Putin is lashing out because he thought he'd kind of fix the Ukraine with his $15 billion buy-off. And so when that didn't stick, the pesky people going out into the square, he's lashing out because he has to kind of save face. So that kind of leads to the second part, which is that he's doing this all out of weakness. Now, are they tweaking him when they say that? They're like, oh, you're doing this out of weakness. You're a little, you know, is that a public go at his ego, or
maybe.
Where do you think
I mean,
that comes
I know
from?
That they're
or
really,
is it wishful thinking?
It's probably a little bit of both. I know they're really fed up with him. I heard a lot of expletives coming out of the White House when Edward Snowden landed in Moscow. But I don't. This isn't weakness. He's exploiting our inability to do anything. He knows that there's really nothing we can do, that Europe, which could do something, isn't going to because it's scared.
Right, he's calling everyone's bluff, and he's right, actually.
Yeah, he's absolutely
right.
And,
you know, once it happened, it had this feeling of inevitability about it to me of, oh, well, right, he just realized there was a way to change this geographical equation, and he's completely right. And this will feel like Georgia soon enough, probably.
Well, this is really depressing, Julia, so I think we should talk about marijuana instead. Julia Yaffe from The New Republic, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, everybody must get stoned. How did the pot legalization movement get so big so fast? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. You're listening to the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. The D.C. Council overwhelmingly passed a bill that would decriminalize marijuana in this city. It will become law.
Has some fans in this room.
So that assumes that Congress doesn't overturn it. D.C. already has legal medical marijuana. Colorado and Washington's full legalization have taken effect. Colorado is reporting vastly more tax revenue than the state anticipated. And the decriminalization movement is also racing forward. Oregon and Alaska are pushing legalization. Florida has a medical pot initiative on the ballot. And the Obama administration is pretty clearly turning a blind eye to this. We did quite seriously consider having one of us get high before the show.
And our producer, Andy Bowers, was horrified.
See if you could guess which one of us.
As were my children horrified. They were so unhappy.
Let me be clear, we didn't do that. Please pass the Doritos, Emily. Did Emily volunteer?
I did volunteer because we always have a drink before the show. It seemed to me that the whole idea is that it's not that different. But
instead, we put vodka in here in honor of the Russians.
Exactly.
So, Emily, D.C. is moving towards decriminalization, which is not legalization. Colorado and Washington have legalization. Is there what's the major distinction between decriminalization and legalization, and is it important?
Well, I think this is a quasi-in-between state on the path to legalization. The benefit of decriminalization is that you stop throwing people in prison for long periods of time for behavior that we are gradually moving towards seeing as okay. And we know that enforcement of marijuana laws in particular disproportionately affects Black people and poor people. So there's a benefit to not having that discriminatory impact on them. On the other hand, you can't buy it in store. You don't have the whole regulatory framework that we're getting in Colorado and Washington, which is so fun to watch unfold. And you don't get all the tax revenue because you haven't legalized the sale. So you're essentially turning a blind eye to production, distribution, rather than trying to incorporate it into the state.
Seems like the worst of both worlds.
Kind of. I mean, it is good that you're not sending people into prison. Like, that's I would say that's the main benefit of legalization, and so decriminalization offers that. It just doesn't have any of the goodies for the state and any of the protections and benefits.
But the goodies from the state is, so when you, if you think about things that are, you know, sins that have been legalized, you think about gambling or alcohol, states end up hugely addicted to that tax revenue. So once you legalize it, you're kind of like, you got it, and you got to smoke it. I mean, you're really there with it.
That's true.
Colorado is going to have this situation where they're $134 million in tax revenue. They are not going to give that money up.
More than they expected, and that entices other states to jump on board. And D.C. is just going to be picking up fine revenue as it starts fining people $25 for getting high in public, right? Because you're still not supposed to do that.
Wasn't it almost twice what they expected in Colorado? Didn't they expect 70 and they got 135? I mean, that's a lot of. I mean, it would have been fun to be the accountant trying to figure that out, you know, and doing the budgeting.
I wonder if they lowballed it because it doesn't. I mean, the sales have been very brisk, but they haven't opened a huge number more stores and dispensaries than were planned. So I don't really understand why the numbers.
And also, there is this weird thing, and Emily, you were talking about this a little bit. Because the banking system refuses to recognize these pot businesses, it's a very problematic in terms of its integration to the economy. It seems like that's going to be bad if you're going to have to like exist only handing out huge wads of cash.
But the banks won't recognize because of the federal laws?
Right, because the property that you'd use as collateral could be seized under federal law. And so it still has all these trappings of being an illegal enterprise. And this is the problem of the crack between federal law and state law that's emerged. And even with the Obama administration promising, essentially, to turn a blind eye as long as Colorado doesn't totally screw up, right? That's basically the bargain. The banks want more than that. They want some greater reassurance. And so now the Justice Department is saying some comforting things to the banks. But, you know, the banks have high standards here for good reason. And so this whole question of how you really commercialize this enterprise is like the next problem to solve.
If you legalize, are you in fact opening the door to harder drugs? That has always been the argument. It does not feel to me like that's happening.
Right. No.
And it doesn't feel. No, I don't mean. Is marijuana a gateway drug? I mean, is legalization of pot a gateway to legalization of meth and coke?
Why is there
no national organization for the reform of cocaine laws?
Well, I think the argument, you can't argue that cocaine is essentially harmless, and cocaine also doesn't have a kind of. I'm going to say it, yeah, functional subculture behind it that allows for political organizing.
Yeah, right? But you know what? The banks would get right behind it.
Yeah, I am. And methamphetamine really doesn't have a constituency behind it. And people are like, yo, my teeth are rotten, but please.
The dentists are all for meth.
But I don't know, you know.
They're like,
but
yeah, we're going to have more care. John, do you think we have this administration, Stoner Obama, where they're like, yeah, everyone get high whenever you want. We're not going to do anything about it. But you elect a God-fearing, right-thinking Republican in 2016, and you could have a president whose views on drug laws are different. Do you think there's any chance that you end up with a Justice Department that stops turning a blind eye to it? Or once this has been permitted, basically, the federal drug laws, as they relate to marijuana, are done.
I don't, a couple of things. I think the first fastest piece of evidence is I spent the morning at the Conservative Political Action Conference. And, you know, when you hear speech after speech from Republicans pitching right to conservatives, you kind of hear the What are some of the pillars? Some of the hot buttons and what's being talked about, and so you can see what's kind of the hot topics. Drug legalization, like, not mentioned once.
Interesting.
So school choice mentioned a lot. So anyway, just that little anecdote suggests that it's not going to be a big issue. Also, what's fascinating is the tax piece of it. I mean, so two things. One, it's a tax, which people don't like, but it's a sin tax. So,
which people do
and it brings
like.
In a lot of revenue. But then
it disproportionately affects Democrats, I think.
right, and depresses turnout. So,
no, the youth turnout is up.
It was a cheap joke. Let me have my cheap joke. Also, if it's a federalism issue, you could avoid it on those grounds, too, which is let 50 laboratories of democracy, as long as they're not meth laboratories of democracy. I don't think that that's the territory that they'll spend a lot of time in if you're not even hearing it being used for sort of fake applause.
Also, isn't the presidential calculus that it sort of sucks to be Obama, the person who has to actively turn the blind eye and deal? Like, it's a headache for the, but once one president has done that, then it's everyone else can just go along with that easily and ignore it. Unless
do you worry that
die.
I mean, I was looking at the federal drug laws today. You know, possession of any amount of marijuana is a 1 year, you're eligible for 1 year in prison.
They're quite clear.
And you can get the death penalty for dealing marijuana. The death penalty.
It's pretty crazy. So, you know, what the Department of Justice has said is they are still going to crack down if there is evidence that a lot of pot is leaving Colorado or Washington, if kids are using it, and if people are using it driving. So they're basically trying to kind of keep the brakes on, and those are all things that presumably the state officials are interested in preventing, too.
Do you guys think that in 20 years marijuana is fully legal basically throughout the country, or is this just going to stutter step around?
Huh. I wonder if we could end up with some kind of red state, blue state divide about this. I think 20 years. No, I would say unless something goes wrong, if there are a lot of deaths on the road, if there's a real, you know, if for good reason there's evidence that this turns out to be a bad experiment, then no. But if it seems like a good to neutral experiment that brings in tax revenue, then yes, everyone in 20 years. And in 20 years, I won't be here to be called on my prediction, so it'll all be fine.
We're totally going to do a show in 20 years.
No. Okay.
Okay. That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, the Oscars, they've come and gone. We'll discuss the justice of the awards and the various weirdnesses of the ceremony. And then, going by statistics alone, fraternities are hotbeds of violence and sexual assault. We'll talk about their odd status in a politically correct world with Slate's own Mike Pesca. And finally, is it a fashion, a movement, or just more trend-spotting BS? Hopefully Julia Turner will tell me what to make of something called normcore. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey.
All right. Well, the 2014 Oscars have been broadcast. The awards have been doled out. Dana, any self-respecting Oscar autopsy divides the corpse into three pieces. First, who won what, then the ceremony itself, and finally, the acceptance speeches. So let's start with the first. Did anything surprise or chagrin you?
Well, it was, I mean, in terms of who won what, it was a very predictable Oscars, I would say. The only thing that surprised me was Spike Jonze's win for original screenplay for her. That was a little bit out of the blue for me.
Really? That fits my, I hate to cut you off so soon, but that fits my theory, which is that the indie best movie of the year always wins screenplay. And this goes back to nobody knowing what to do with Pulp Fiction. If it didn't win screenplay, I guess the theory doesn't hold quite as tightly, but anyway.
Also, the fact that it was over 20 years ago. We don't know if any such incidences have occurred in between, but it's a trend.
Those are the bookends. It's happened every year since. Come on, Dana, go with the program.
I mean, 12 Years a Slave winning Best Picture, I would not say that was a surprise. That was certainly one of the favorites, but it was suspenseful. It was very suspenseful when that envelope was opened for me because it had really come down to that movie or Gravity at that point, and those are just two such sort of ideologically opposed movies in terms of the part of Hollywood that they represent, or in 12 Years a Slave's case, sort of outside Hollywood. So that I thought was a meaningful outcome, and one that I was happy about, even though I don't love everything about 12 Years a Slave.
Mm-hmm. I also was surprised to see American Hustle shut out on so many categories, including even costumes, which I thought for sure somebody would have.
Was it nominated for costumes?
It was.
It was hair and makeup that it was.
Yes, it was,
not
it was shockingly shunned for hair and makeup, despite the outrageous coiffures in that movie. But I did think, you know, there was this sense in the run-up that American Hustle, Gravity, and 12 Years a Slave were all going to be vying for some of the big awards. American Hustle was really shut out, and 12 Years a Slave did win Best Picture, although Cuarón took home Best Director, so it was kind of a split. And it did let the audience off the hook from the joke that Ellen DeGeneres, who I thought was actually fairly tart as the host of the Oscars, despite her reputation for being a, like, nice soft shoe dancer all the time. Her opening joke for the whole ceremony was either 12 Years a Slave will win Best Picture or we'll learn that you're all a bunch of racists, and then, like, on with the show, which is you know, a nice little dagger.
I liked that moment. That was the one kind of bomb dropped into a, you know, a pretty mild monologue.
Mm-hmm. What speech, Julia, do you think was an especially interesting one or unexpected one or revealing one? And maybe we could play a little bit of it.
Well, I think one big moment of anticipation was whether Kate Blanchett would win Best Actress for her performance in Woody Allen's film Blue Jasmine, and if so, what she would say about Woody Allen because of the controversy surrounding him and the allegations about him and his daughter. So let's listen a little bit to what she did say.
Thank you so much to the Academy. As random and as subjective as this award is, it means a great deal. In a year of extraordinary, yet again, extraordinary performances by women. Amy Adams, everything you do, but your performance in American Hustle blew my mind. And Meryl, what can I say? Sandra, I could watch that performance to the end of time, and I sort of felt like I had. Julia, hashtag suck it. You know what I mean? And Judi Dench, I mean, what a career. She's not here tonight because at the age of 79, her film was so successful that she's in India doing a sequel. I mean, what a career that is, if I could hope. And me, I'm here accepting an award in an extraordinary screenplay by Woody Allen. Thank you so much, Woody, for casting me. I truly appreciate it.
I think it must have been very difficult to figure out what she should say. And the strategy she seems to have adopted was to try and turn the night into a referendum on movies that star and are really powered by female actresses, which in a year of Gravity and Blue Jasmine is a fair point to make, but didn't necessarily seem to me to be the political issue on the tips of everybody's tongue. And to me, it came off as a slightly bald attempt to say, I'm not anti-woman because I starred in Woody Allen's movie. I'm all about women.
I mean, I sort of disagree with the notion that she needed to do anything special with that speech just because of the scandal that had erupted with Woody Allen since the movie came out. I mean, presumably she knows his whole history and the history of his family going into the project, and, you know, she still wanted to work with him. And I just don't think that that was something that necessarily needed to come into the calculus of what Kate Blanchett should say. Unlike you, I'm not a huge fan of Blue Jasmine or that performance, but I love Kate, so I don't begrudge it her.
Yeah, Dana, I agree with you about Kate Blanchett. I will also say that what I thought was really interesting, my one rooting interest in the whole event was I wanted Matthew McConaughey to win for Dallas Buyers Club, and of course he did, but new Matthew McConaughey won the award, but he sent old Matthew McConaughey up on stage to accept it.
Well, there were several Matthew McConaughey's up on stage. It was like a club.
Yeah. But let's listen to Matthew McConaughey's acceptance speech.
Now, when I was 15 years old, I had a very important person in my life come to me and say, who's your hero? And I said, I don't know, I got to think about that. Give me a couple of weeks. I come back 2 weeks later, this person comes up and says, who's your hero? I said, I thought about it. You know who it is? I said, it's me in 10 years. So I turned 25 10 years later. That same person comes to me and goes, so are you a hero? And I was like, not even close. No. She said, why? I said, because my hero is me at 35. So you see, every day, every week, every month, and every year of my life, my hero is always 10 years away. I'm never going to be my hero. I'm not going to attain that. I know I'm not. And that's just fine with me because that keeps me with somebody to keep on chasing. So to any of us, whatever those things are, whatever it is we look up to, whatever it is we look forward to, and whoever it is we're chasing, to that I say amen. To that I say all right, all right, all right. And to that I say just keep living, huh? Thank you.
All right. Well, Steve, unlike you, I had a rooting interest for Bruce Dern in this category because it felt like it was sort of his turn to be recognized. But obviously, Matthew McConaughey was incredible in Dallas Buyers Club. He's having a great moment in his career. It doesn't surprise me at all that he won the Oscar. That speech really rubbed me the wrong way. I mean, actually, I was quite charmed by the sheer goofiness of it, but the fact that there was no mention whatsoever of Ron Woodruff, the man that he played in Dallas Buyers Club, or of the AIDS crisis, or of anything that the movie was about, struck me as shockingly narcissistic, even for a Hollywood Oscar speech.
Yeah, I mean, people had, I think, an image of Matthew McConaughey for the, you know, X number of years that he spent kind of in the wilderness doing cookie-cutter rom-coms with Kate Hudson. And then he shed it so completely. It's a turnaround like none one has ever seen. And he became a tremendous actor, but he didn't shed some essence of himself that really is closer to those rom-coms in some weird way.
But doesn't that, I found that the whole thing made me even more impressed with Matthew McConaughey because it makes it seem like actually he is that Kate Hudson, like, consort at heart. Like he has the soul and mental capacity of someone who should just be like on a yacht with Kate Hudson, and yet somehow he's found all these like deep, tortured, dark roles somewhere within himself. It's like he's this blank slate channeling all these interesting emotional currents in these roles. And I could listen to that man talk and say words for hours, like the crazy intonations and rhythms that he puts in things. Jean-Marc Vallée. Like, he's just got a great way of saying words. And in terms of whether he mentioned the content of the movie and the actual work and what it was really about, in the abstract, I completely get that that is the right thing to do. But I actually found the speeches that did try to talk about the important subjects of a number of the nominated movies and winning movies to ring sort of hollow and cheap. Like, I feel like you cannot actually do justice to slavery or the AIDS crisis in a glittering dress in 30 seconds while you're frantically thanking your agent. Like, it doesn't really seem like the right forum to say something. Obviously, various actors pull this off.
I didn't want McConaughey not to enjoy himself, not to be funny, not to bust out in his speech. It just seemed like it was such a portmanteau speech that contained so many bizarre moments, including, you know, his self-help directive of how to make your 10 years future self the person that you're always chasing. There would have been room to just throw in there the proper name of the guy he played.
You know, I wonder if we know, like, if we can, like, go 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon and pull every string we have and make a ton of phone calls and get Matthew McConaughey to say the word portmanteau just into a microphone.
I bet he'd say it. I'm imagining him saying it with his accent.
It would take him, yeah, he would put four new vowels in it.
Portmanteau.
All right, well, come to our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest, and let us know what you thought of the winners and the losers. Was it, were there travesties? Was it just ringing bell of justice? Let us know. We're curious to hear. Coming up, The Dark Power of Fraternities. You're listening to GapFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GapFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GapFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mentioned on the program, well, we collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/GapFest. And please, while you're there, if you would, just leave a comment and tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/GapFest. The writer Caitlin Flanagan has a classic Dead Trees long-form piece of journalism in the March Atlantic Monthly. It's called The Dark Power of Fraternities, and it has a long subtitle, but I think I should read it. It's a year-long investigation of Greek houses reveals their endemic, lurid, and sometimes tragic problems and a sophisticated system for shifting the blame. Mike Pesca, we asked you on because you're the closest thing to a Dartmouth lax bro that exists in the Slate universe. This is, of course, Mike Pesca of Slate.com, and we need you to mansplain this article to us. That's why you've been brought in. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
You were in a fraternity.
Not only was I in a fraternity, I was the vice president of the Interfraternity Council.
Whoa.
So, yeah,
really?
That's right.
Oh, my God. What university was this at?
It was Emory University.
And what fraternity was it?
It was an AEPI, okay. Which in Animal House was probably the one that was referred to as the Jewish fraternity said. Yeah, that was probably us.
All right. Well, Mike, as you can imagine, a piece like this is just one, you know, beta male hot button after another to someone like me. But I'm very curious, how did it ring true to you? Were there parts in the piece where you thought, this doesn't pass my own personal smell test? What do you think?
One, it was extremely well written. It was hysterical. I commend anyone to read the first three paragraphs. I mean, it's just very funny. And she took a tone that I didn't expect. I thought it would be the parade of horribles that is usually written about fraternities. And most of the criticism of fraternities, if I'm here in some sort of capacity to defend the system of fraternities, I can't really do it full-throatedly. You know, there are, the problems that you think are problems with fraternities really are problems. And she gets to a lot of them. And I think mostly we think about things like sexual assault, which absolutely happens, and excessive drinking and unsafe behavior. But I really do credit something I never thought of, which the basic premise of her piece, other than the parts that deal with sexual assault, is just how unsafe, like the failure to adhere to building codes mm-hmm. that fraternities often have. And that was endemic in my fraternity and all the fraternities that I knew of. And it just shouldn't be. I mean, if you have a place on a college campus that is there to house students, I don't see why the college can't come in and insist that every porch be built with a railing. And one of the things I had never heard of before, something called a sleeping porch, where it just seems insane. Beds are put next to windows on the third floor and people keep falling out of these beds. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's stupid on behalf of the fraternities. It's good that she writes about it, but I don't see how that could even be allowed to continue existing.
But part of what she is writing about is that fraternities in many ways legally escape the strictures, right, that the university imposes on its own housing, which saves the university money and creates an alternate system where essentially 18-year-olds are running the show. They're making the safety decisions about railings. They're making the decisions about drinking at parties, and they're just outside of the college's jurisdiction.
You're right. So Flanagan does talk about how the national fraternities have pretty much executed this dodge. They have these rules that their member institutions have to follow. Only no member institutions ever follow the rules. Like, at a party, anyone who brings a beer is over 21, and they check their beer in at the door, and then they redeem it for tickets. No one ever follows those rules. And once the rule is not followed, that gets the national fraternity off the hook. So you really have, I know 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds are technically adults, but you really have adults, sophisticated adults, who are part of this national organization, protecting themselves. And the people on the hook are these 18 and 19-year-olds, or more specifically, their parents, who have to pay out settlements out of their homeowners' insurance. And the big fraternities never have to pay the bill. I totally credit Caitlin Flanagan with pointing that out.
Mm-hmm. You know, the question is whether, you know, Bloomberg.com is not a hotbed of Maoist, thinking, has called for the abolition of fraternities. It's not completely outside the mainstream to say that these things are anachronistic and have no place in a current university. What's the intelligent defense?
I'll do my best. A lot of the problems with the fraternities do seem to be that it seems to me that there is a problem, a societal problem, with what to do with, say, 18 to 22-year-old men. And when you look at the institutions that are dominated by 18 to 22-year-old men, or you want to, you know, when you talk about things like the military, and when you talk about fraternities, and when you talk about the NFL, there are huge problems with all these institutions. And I just think that some of our cultural institutions, certainly like a college, don't really know how to deal with these, you know, highly testosterone-filled young men on their hands, and the options they give them are not going to appeal to all of us.
Yeah, but you just made a case against them. Isn't the worst thing to do with a bunch of testosterone-filled 18 to 22-year-olds to throw them in a single house, tell them that it's a civilization-free zone, right, and a parent-free and administration-free zone, and leave them be, you know, in absentia parentis? That's terrible.
Yeah, well, this is why some schools, like in Caitlin's article, Wesleyan was one of the schools where there was a fraternity that was a kind of problem. But what they did was they made all the fraternities co-ed. This seems like, well, I think that that is an interesting idea that could work. It didn't work in this one case. I think Wesleyan probably handled that wrong. But there are other ways where the school could work with fraternities and to try to maybe give them constructive things to do rather than, you know, just drink in their spare time.
All right. I would find that a modestly to not very persuasive defense of the fraternity,
that's all
Mike.
I'm going for.
But I do. I mean, I think the thing you point out is that when a student enters a university, they need to find a network of support and collegiality and friendship and comradeship, and that fraternities and other social groups are a natural way to do that. I mean, there's going to be organizations like that. And I think one of the tragedies that Caitlin Flanagan's piece points out is that there are lots of forces that are aligned and opposed around fraternities in ways that don't actually make sense. And I think it's a testament to the rhetorical brilliance of her piece. And I actually think it's one of the best magazine articles I've read in 5 years in terms of the reporting, the sheer vim and vigor of its sentence level writing, and then the cleverness and craftiness of its argument. Because what she does here, instead of, you know, decrying the fraternity and saying what 1,000 op-ed people at Bloomberg have said over the years, which is they should be shut down, these ruthless barbarians, she basically pits fraternity members against their national organizations and talks about how these young men and their parents are being hung out to dry by these pompous, well-funded, nationally centralized fraternity groups. And so that if you are a young fraternity brother or a recent graduate or alumni, you might read this piece and recognize perhaps how your national organizing body helped you respond to the time. Maybe nobody died in your fraternity, but maybe there was that one time that young Mike, the pledge, got alcohol poisoning and you all had to go to the emergency room at midnight and the national body came and talked to you about it. And the ways that they handled it that maybe put you and your family at risk that you didn't recognize at the time when they were really covering their own ass. And I think she also points out ways in which the schools and the local fraternity chapters are aligned around issues of housing. I mean, it suggests that it might not be that hard.
I'm going to push back a little bit and say we're concentrating on railings and, you know, maybe a hall monitor here or there. Isn't the essence of this story the prevailing attitude that fraternities encourage about young women? Right, that this really is about sexual predation, and that's the epidemic, right? That we could tolerate a degree of hijinks and, you know, a couple of trips to the emergency room, and maybe we can even statistically norm it and discover that it's no more lethal to be in a fraternity than it is to be in a freshman dorm. But at the end of the day, the thing that is completely unacceptable is that if I have two daughters and I'm trying to pick where, you know, I'm trying to help them choose where they're going to go to school, and I'm going to give them a talk before they enroll there, and they're not even safe at Wesleyan because of the three fraternities and what they're allowed to pull, that, to me, that is an immense moral failure. That is a huge moral failure.
Yeah, it does seem reasonable to me to say be extremely wary of your interactions at fraternities. Thus ends the worst spokesman for fraternity.
All right. Well, I'm not going to read its whole subhead again, but the piece is called The Dark Power of Fraternities. It's something of a tour de force. It's by the writer Caitlin Flanagan, and it's in the March issue of The Atlantic Monthly.
I would call it full tour de force.
You're going full?
Full tour de force.
I'm with you. Thanks, Mike.
All right.
All right, moving on. Stonewashed jeans, fleece vests, comfortable sneakers, Williamsburg hipsters have started wearing clothes that render them indistinguishable from Dubuque tourists. New York Magazine has cottoned on to this self-aware, stylized blandness, as writer Fiona Duncan put it, and she quickly traced it to a movement called Normcore. Julia, I'm lost already. What is Normcore? What is this about? Why is it important? Why are we talking about it?
All right. So let me offer you a little bit of a Normcore etymology. So New York Magazine, in its fashion section, had an article about the rise of Normcore written by Fiona Duncan, which argued that we've reached a moment where style has become so atomized, so individualistic. Everyone is striving so hard to have custom, bespoke, specially found in a vintage shop in Saskatchewan objects that don't look like anybody else, that the only possible next phase is for everyone to embrace either looking like everybody else or not caring at all what they look like, or basically just wearing huge boxy basics that you found in the back of your dad's wardrobe without regard to aesthetic distinction. But I'm curious what you guys thought. Did you think this was a compelling argument about the state of modern aesthetics, or did it just flag your BS indicators?
Okay, this is going to be my day on the GabFest, obviously, to kind of hand-wring about political obliviousness after what I said about Matthew McConaughey's Oscar speech. But the fact that there was no mention whatsoever in this, including with this slideshow of everybody wearing kind of mass-produced Nike garments and, you know, just boxy athletic gear, about the conditions of production of the garments? Like, is part of Normcore going to be that we just cheerfully go to the Gap and buy mass-produced Indonesian garments with horrible labor conditions? I mean, is there going to be, in other words, is there any political element to this supposedly millennial generation movement of Normcore? Or is it just, hey, we're all just going to give up and go to the mall?
I mean, I completely with you, Dana. It has all the spirit of the ante, but all of the actuality of total conform. You know, it's just in search of a new label and a new set of habits of conformism. I mean, just none of it strikes me as true. I mean, I agree with the insight behind one of the manifesto's statements, which is once upon a time people were born into communities and had to find their individuality. That describes the entire trajectory of the novel as a literary art form. And then they add, now people are born individuals and have to find their communities. I think that there is a very, very important shred of truth to that, which is that, you know, in a modern, postmodern, consumer, affluent society, you're born with this precious thing called individuality, which is given no firm institutional ballast, right? It's not given to you by your parents, your school, your church, or anything.
Your fraternity.
Or your fraternity, anything really extrinsic to yourself. But it's flattered endlessly by elaborate systems of marketing. And then you feel the burden of the individuality of having to do it justice, and you go out and purchase things. I mean, it's a very consumerist mentality. And our bull detector has to be set on very high degrees of fineness in order to pick up when someone is just trying to sell us our own skepticism back to us. And this strikes me as an instance of this in the works.
To me, what's interesting intellectually about this is not so much the fine point particulars of anybody framing this as a political movement, but more just the sheer notion of, like, what happens to fashion trends after the decade we've had, where the prevailing fashion trend is individualization, customization. I mean, I think you can say that that decade of fashion trends had more to do with a response to globalization and the fact of, like, wow, I have the same bag and jacket as, like, anybody who shops at this international Globo chain around the world. So instead, I'm going to go to Etsy and I'm going to get a custom macrame purse and I'm going to distress my own leather jacket that I found somewhere. You know, like, the notion that what comes next, because there always has to be a next in fashion, right, is giving up on that pursuit and instead embracing the notion of looking like everyone else, whether it's looking like a specific aesthetic notion of everyone else, which is like the boxy jeans and the Seinfeld clothes, or this more particular situated, like, if I live in Greenwich, Connecticut, I'm going to wear pearls and a sweater set, and if I live in, you know, wherever else, I'm going to dress in whatever the prevailing uniform there. I found that to be intellectually interesting, not as a political statement necessarily, but just as a notion of where style trends might go.
But doesn't it strike you that the one of the games that fashion plays at our expense is it pursues the outrageous in part as a way of showing that a certain kind of person can pull off anything, right? That only a certain kind of person gets admitted to the vanguard of fashion because of the way they look or the way they act. And therefore, that, you know, that group of people can put any old wackadoodle thing on their person and pull it off. And this is just a version of the same thing, that if we were all to wear a kind of Maoist uniform, bland uniform, we would still know who those people are. And we still know that it's important that they're wearing it and not important that the tourist from Dubuque is wearing it. So I think the same old hierarchy of insults is still in place.
That's probably true.
All right. Well, the piece, once again, is in New York Magazine. It's called Normcore, Fashion for Those Who Realize They're 1 in 7 Billion. It was written by Fiona Duncan. Check it out. Tell us what you wear, how you've normed yourself to the core on our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. All right. Now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana Stevens. What do you have?
I have an endorsement that's one of the ones I'm the most enthusiastic about in quite some time, and I really just hope that I don't start to weep as I'm describing this endorsement. So if you watch the Academy Awards, you no doubt witnessed a moment where the best live-action documentary short was awarded, and the award was given to a movie called The Lady in Number 6, which is a documentary, a 38-minute-long short documentary about the oldest living Holocaust survivor who actually now has died. She died just a few days before the final Oscar voting. Anyway, this movie really, really affected me. I've been thinking about this woman ever since I saw it, Alice Hertz Sommer, who was a classical pianist. And during the war, she and her son and her husband went to Theresienstadt, which was a kind of model camp that the Nazis had set up, this very ghoulish Potemkin village where they sort of pretended that, you know, the Jews they had interned were producing all these cultural projects and making art, and they had an orchestra. She played in the orchestra at Terezin. She and her son survived the war, and she went on to practice classical piano every day for hours for the rest of her life. And she is just the most incredible, inspiring person. She's like a saint of some kind, a Jewish saint. But the wisdom that she dispenses in this documentary, without in the least feeling like she's dispensing wisdom, just sort of speaking about her life and about music and about her family, is just... it's just so galvanizing. It's something that will make you feel like it's possible to live your life in a happier and simpler and more beautiful way. So I don't know how to endorse it any more strongly than that. The Lady in Number 6, and we'll put a link to how to watch it on our show page.
Oh my God, that sounds amazing. Julia Turner, what do you have?
My endorsement pales in comparison to Dana's, which does sound incredible. But one way to lead a happier life is to make a really delicious strata for brunch. And so I'm just going to endorse a strata recipe. I just have to embrace the fact that, of the strata slash life-transforming saint juxtaposition. But I'm sure even saints like to eat eggs for breakfast.
Oh, I'm sure Alice Hurt Summer would love a breakfast strata.
You know, sometimes you need something to make for something in like 3 hours and you don't know what to do. And you go online and you pull a recipe out of the ether and you just hope it works out. And it does. That happened to me with a spinach strata recipe that I found on the Smitten Kitchen food blog, which is, it's very simple, and the model seems to be like one smart woman who's a good cook in her kitchen who takes good photographs of her food and just writes charmingly and colloquially about what she does. But the recipes just keep working.
Oh, yeah.
Yum.
All right. My endorsement is not original in any way whatsoever, but it is by far and away the best thing that I encountered this past week. I, by accident, total kismet, just pulled a book off the shelf, and I reread Orwell's essay, Lear, Tolstoy, and the Fool. As a work of literary criticism, it does this one fantastic thing that every work of literary criticism should aspire to, which is it solves a kind of mystery, which is, why did Tolstoy violently hate Shakespeare? Why would Tolstoy loathe him? And not just loathe him a little bit. In his old age, Tolstoy took it upon himself to reread all of Shakespeare in order to make sure that this to make sure that it wasn't a trick of his imagination. And in fact, he found that he hated it more than ever and wrote an entire essay about this. And Orwell writes an essay about that essay. It is a fantastic diagnosis of why Tolstoy hated him. It's just one of the best pieces of writings I've ever read, and I'd forgotten about it completely.
That sounds amazing.
Can you say the title one more time?
It's called Lear, Tolstoy, and the Fool. It's actually online. It's not a very long piece of writing. It's completely available online. It's also in the Orwell Reader, which is where I found it. I just can't recommend it highly enough.
I cannot wait to read that.
That sounds so good. All right, so we've got galvanizing saints, we've got life-affirming essays, and then we've got egg pudding.
That's an evening right there.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Julia, thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. The executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.
Drinking brandy at a bar with an old-time movie star. Her makeup is faded and her fame is dated. She says her place ain't very far. Razzmatazz.